From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
A controversial counterterrorism program at the Defense Department, known as Total Information Awareness, which lawmakers thought they'd halted more than 2 years ago, has actually been continuing under a different name with the same contractors at a research facility housed at the National Security Agency.
Total Information Awareness lives on. We'll speak with the reporter who broke the story. Then we'll look at the U.S.-run prison, where hundreds of men have been held for years without charge. No, not Guantanamo, Bagram in Afghanistan, and it's growing.
As calls to close Guantanamo base get stronger, the U.S. administration is expanding another gulag, Bagram, Afghanistan. Over 500 prisoners are in Bagram under primitive conditions with no legal rights.
We'll speak with Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and Clive Stafford Smith, who's represented prisoners at Bagram. Then we'll talk to Maher Arar, the Canadian citizen who was detained by the U.S. government and sent to Syria, where he was jailed and tortured.
When I arrived there, I just couldn't believe it. I thought first it was a dream. I was crying all the time. I was disoriented. I wished I had something in my hand to kill myself, because I knew I was going to be tortured, and this was my preoccupation. That's all I was thinking about when I was on the plane.
A U.S. federal judge has dismissed a lawsuit Maher Arar filed challenging what the government calls extraordinary rendition. Others call it kidnapping. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Afghanistan, the New York Times is reporting the U.S. military is now indefinitely holding 500 detainees in wire cages at the Bagram Air Base in primitive conditions, described as worse than Guantanamo. The U.S. has been expanding the jail at Bagram at a time that international pressure is growing to close Guantanamo. Unlike detainees at Guantanamo, individuals held at the site in Afghanistan have no access to lawyers and no right to hear the allegations against them. The U.S. military has barred any outside visitors, except for the International Red Cross. The prison may not even be photographed. Comparing the prison with Guantanamo, one Pentagon official said, quote, anyone who's been to Bagram would tell you it's worse. Meanwhile, four people have died inside another Afghan jail after prisoners connected to the Taliban and al-Qaeda took control of part of the jail. Police said at least 1,500 prisoners have barricaded themselves inside the prison. In Iraq, at least 29 people died on Sunday, even though security forces had imposed a rare daytime curfew barring all vehicular traffic in Baghdad and its suburbs. In the deadliest attack, a Shiite neighborhood came under mortar fire in southwest Baghdad. 16 people died, another 53 were injured. Over 200 people have been killed since Wednesday's bombing at a holy Shiite shrine in Samarra. On Saturday, gunmen broke into the home of a Shia family northeast of Baghdad and killed 13 people. Three people also died Saturday during the funeral of Atwar Bajat, the well-known Al Arabiya journalist who was killed last week. She'd previously worked for Al Jazeera. Meanwhile, there's been no word on the status of kidnapped U.S. journalist Jill Carroll. Her captors had threatened to kill her by Sunday, unless the U.S. released all Iraqi female prisoners. Carroll was freelancing for the Christian Science Monitor. She was kidnapped on January 7th. In other news from Iraq, the Independent of London's reporting, the United Nations has determined hundreds of Iraqis are being tortured to death or summarily executed every month in Baghdad by Shia death squads working from the Ministry of the Interior. According to John Pace, the outgoing United Nations human rights chief in Iraq, up to three-quarters of the corpses stacked in the Baghdad mortuary show evidence of gunshot wounds to the head or injuries caused by drill bits or burning cigarettes. Pace said figures show that last July, the morgue alone received 1,100 bodies, about 900 of which were evidence of torture or summary execution. In news on Hurricane Katrina, a federal judge has ruled against a request for the state of Louisiana to create out-of-state satellite polling places for evacuees temporarily living outside of Louisiana. New Orleans is scheduled to hold a primary election on April 22nd. the Washington-based advancement project called the ruling a blow for Katrina survivors. In a statement, the group said, quote, the effect of this adverse ruling means more than 100,000 people, predominantly people of color, will have to use absentee ballots, with evacuees being forced to move from location to location. The likelihood that an absentee ballot will even reach them is dramatically reduced. In other Katrina news, officials in Texas are reporting the state is facing a health crisis because nearly half the 50,000 evacuees living in Houston have no health insurance. Most of the evacuees had been covered by a special Medicaid waiver, but that waiver expired at the end of January. In political news, a defense contractor admitted Friday he paid former Republican Congressmember Randy Duke Cunningham of California more than $1 million in bribes. Michael Wade, the former president of the defense contractor MZM, also admitted to making a total of $80,000 in illegal donations to other members of Congress. Press accounts have identified the two as Republicans, Catherine Harris of Florida and Virgil Good of Virginia. Wade faces up to 20 years in prison. In Saudi Arabia, the world's largest oil processing plant came under attack Friday when three suicide car bombers attempted to blast their way into the facility. Al-Qaeda took responsibility for the plot, which marked the first time the group tried to stage direct strikes on Saudi oil targets. A successful attack on the plant would have had a devastating effect on the world's economy. The Abqaiq plant accounts for 10% of the world's daily oil output, and nearly two-thirds of Saudi Arabia's oil flows through the facility. Earlier today, Saudi security forces in Riyadh announced they had killed five men, believed linked to the attack. The New York Times is reporting the Army has decided to reimburse a Halliburton subsidiary for nearly all its disputed costs on a $2.4 billion no-bid contract to deliver fuel and repair oil equipment in Iraq. Auditors had recommended the Army withhold $263 million from Kellogg Brown and Root, but the Army decided to withhold just $10 million. California Congressmember Henry Waxman said, quote, Halliburton gouged the taxpayer. Government auditors caught the company red-handed, yet the Pentagon ignored the auditors and paid Halliburton hundreds of millions of dollars and a huge bonus. In Uganda, members of the Opposition Forum for Democratic Change Party are alleging massive voting fraud marred last week's national election, the country's first multi-party poll since 1980. On Saturday, the country's electoral commission announced Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni had won the election. Museveni has ruled Uganda since coming to power in 1986 coup. Meanwhile, in other news from Africa, Reuters is reporting thousands of civilians have taken refuge on floating islands in the lakes of Congo's Katanga province to escape rape and murder by government and militia fighters. Some 120,000 people have fled their homes in the remote Mtwaba area, where hundreds of women have been raped during fighting between the army and former pro-government militia. In news from the Caribbean, Jamaica is set to have its first ever female prime minister. Portia Simpson Miller has been elected head of the governing People's National Party and will replace PJ Patterson after he steps down in the coming weeks. Patterson has led Jamaica for the past 14 years. And science fiction writer Octavia Butler has died at the age of 58. She died on Friday night after a fall outside her home in Washington State. Her best-known work included Parable of the Talents and Kindred. Butler was considered to be one of the first African-American women to break into the world of science fiction. Jane Jewell of the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America said, quote, she is a world-class science fiction writer in her own right. She was one of the first and one of the best to discuss gender and race in science fiction, she said. Octavia Butler joined us 4 months ago in our studios here at Democracy Now!
I'm going to read a verse or two, and keep in mind these were written early in the 90s, but I think they apply forever, actually. This first one, I have a character in the books who is, someone who is taking the country fascist and who manages to get elected president. And who, oddly enough, comes from Texas. And here is one of the things that my character is inspired to write about this sort of situation. She says, choose your leaders with wisdom and forethought. To be led by a coward is to be controlled by all that the coward fears. To be led by a fool is to be led by the opportunists who control the fool. To be led by a thief is to offer up your most precious treasures to be stolen. To be led by a liar is to ask to be lied to. To be led by a tyrant is to sell yourself and those you love into slavery.
Octavia Butler in our studios at Democracy Now! She died this weekend after falling and hitting her head. She died at the age of 58 in Washington State. To hear the full interview, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. And those are the headlines. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A controversial counterterrorism program halted by Congress more than 2 years ago has quietly continued within the National Security Agency, this according to a new report in the National Journal. In 2003, lawmakers voted to shut down Total Information Awareness, a program that developed technologies to predict terrorist attacks by mining government databases and the personal records of people in the United States. The program was halted primarily because of privacy concerns, but also because its main advocate was John Poindexter, known for his involvement with the Iran-Contra scandal of the 1980s. It now appears the project was stopped in name only, and that TIA is in fact continuing. The National Journal reports TIA was moved from the Pentagon's Research and Development Agency, known by its acronym DARPA, to another group which builds technologies primarily for the NSA. The names of key projects were changed, apparently to conceal their identities, but their funding remains intact, often under the same contracts. The issue resurfaced earlier this month when, during a hearing of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, asked John Negroponte, the head of domestic security, Robert Mueller, the head of the FBI, and General Michael Hayden, the former head of the NSA, about the project.
Is it correct that when John Poindexter's program, Operation Total Information Awareness, was closed, that several of Mr. Poindexter's projects were moved to various intelligence agencies?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Do any of the other panel members know? The press has reported intelligence officials saying that those programs run by Mr. Poindexter, I and others on this panel led the effort to close it. We want to know if Mr. Poindexter's programs are going on somewhere else. Can anyone answer that? Mr. Mueller?
I have no knowledge of that, sir.
Any other panel members?
Senator, I'd like to answer you in closed session.
That was Michael Hayden, the former head of the NSA, saying he'd like to answer in closed session, being questioned by Oregon's Senator Ron Wyden. As we turn now to Washington, to Shane Harris. He's the reporter who broke the story for the National Journal. It's called TIA Lives On. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Shane.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, why don't you just start off by telling us how you learned about what is happening here, where TIA is now living?
Right. Well, I've been following TIA and some other related kind of data mining work for a number of years. When TIA started up in 2002, it was a fairly big story for folks who were covering intelligence and homeland security. And you know, when it went away, there was always sort of a general awareness, if you will, that there were some components of the project that had lived on, but no one was really willing to say where they had gone. That information actually was, according to informed sources that I have, was classified. And I recently just came into possession of some documents that really helped spell out where these projects went, when they moved, and what the names were changed to. So sort of confirming what people generally knew, but in a very specific context this way.
So tell us exactly how TIA originated, where it was, and now how it's been broken up and the different areas within the NSA it is.
Right. Well, TIA was sort of the brainchild of two people. John Poindexter, whom you mentioned in your introduction, of course, was Ronald Reagan's national security advisor. He and a colleague, a man named Brian Sharkey, brought this idea for a system of systems that would bring together data mining tools and analysis tools to help the government predict and preempt terrorist attacks. It is really right after the 9/11 attacks. The Pentagon was pretty keen on this idea. Both Poindexter and Sharkey had worked on similar projects for the Pentagon before as contractors and as officials. And in early 2002, the Pentagon created at DARPA something called the Information Awareness Office and put Poindexter in charge of it. And this office really was meant to build TIA and to look into things like data mining, pattern recognition, software that can translate something from Arabic into English text automatically, and kind of tie all these together in a sort of big prototype, which was called at the time TIA, and that office was in charge of it. When news broke that this had been going on for several months, the controversy was sort of fanned not only by the privacy concerns that are raised by something like this, but also by Poindexter at least sort of being the titular head and the brainchild of all this, and the program was then shut down, essentially, in name only. In the 2004 Defense Authorization Act, this being the bill that authorizes the government to spend money on defense programs, TIA and most of its components were specifically eliminated under DARPA, and there was sort of a loophole that was left open that funding could continue for certain projects out of the National Foreign Intelligence Program, which is the black budget of the intelligence community. At that point, the project sort of went behind that black curtain, and no one was really sure where they had gone. But what my reporting now has confirmed is that really quickly after Congress shut down TIA at DARPA, a new sponsor came forward, this new sponsor being this research and development office that's actually housed at NSA headquarters, not here, not far from outside of Washington here, and picked up the projects, changed their names to conceal their identities, kept the same contractors that were working under TIA in place, kept the same language, the same specifications, and really just continued the work. And presumably, it has expanded significantly from where it was 3 years ago.
We're talking to Shane Harris of National Journal. I wanted to read from a William Sapphire column from a couple of years ago. The conservative columnist in the New York Times writes, "If the Homeland Security Act is not amended before passage, here is what will happen to you. Every purchase you make with a credit card, every magazine subscription you buy and medical prescription you fill, every website you visit and email you send or receive, every academic grade you receive, every bank deposit you make, every trip you book, and every event you attend, all these transactions and communications will go into what the Defense Department describes as a virtual centralized grand database. To this computerized dossier on your private life from commercial sources, add every piece of information that government has about you, passport application, driver's license, and bridge toll records, judicial and divorce records, complaints from nosy neighbors to the FBI, your lifetime paper trail, plus the latest hidden camera surveillance. And you have the Super Snoop's dream, a total information awareness about every U.S. citizen. This is not some far-out Orwellian scenario. It's what will happen to your personal freedom in the next few weeks if John Poindexter gets the unprecedented power he seeks." Those are the words of the conservative columnist who had once worked for Richard Nixon, William Sapphire. Shane Harris of the National Journal, given what you understand of the components of this, though the public understands TIA was done away with, the components of this that live on.
What components are living on? Yeah, essentially there are two main pieces. The first being the most important. It was something called the Information Awareness Prototype System, which is essentially a long name for the heart of TIA. It was the hardware, if you will, the architecture that was going to tie together what Bill Sapphire is really describing there in his piece, this thing that would sit at the center and collect them all. That piece lives on. It was renamed Basketball, rather innocuous-seeming name that my reporting could find no
indication of why basketball was chosen as the name for this. That continued at the NSA Research Office under the direction of SAIC Corporation, which is an intelligence and defense contractor, which was working on the original prototype system. The second piece that I found that continued was something called Genoa 2. This was not TIA per se, it was a connected program trying to build analysis tools, software, all kinds of different things that would eventually feed into TIA. So it was really sort of a key component in tandem with it. That was continued under the name Topsail, also at the same place where basketball went. Research continued on that with, as well, some of the same contractors, and apparently new contractors were brought in as well. So what you have here is sort of the heart or core architecture of TIA, and one of the biggest, most important application or tool pieces. You know, you would put these two together, you really would have the bulk of what TIA was before Congress effectively killed it or thought they had killed it.
Shane Harris, 18 Democratic Congress members are calling for a special counsel to investigate eavesdropping by the NSA. How does this whole issue of Americans being spied on that is currently raging, there'll be a hearing on tomorrow, relate to total information awareness?
Right. That is sort of the key question now. TIA, as it existed under DARPA when Poindexter was in charge, was running at the same time as the NSA eavesdropping program that the president is authorized to eavesdrop on Americans without warrants. So then officials at both agencies were aware of each other's work. That's that much we know. Whether or not NSA actually took some of the experimental tools, the searching, retrieval, the data mining tools that TIA was developing, took those and applied that to the information, the data that it was getting from U.S. citizens from their phone calls and their emails, that remains uncertain. But certainly what is known is at the time the people who were running the NSA program, who have ultimately built the technology that's at the core of the NSA program, were very much aware of what was going on under TIA. In fact, what was going on under Total Information Awareness was not classified. There were, Poindexter had given speeches about this. There were conferences where DARPA had invited contractors to come in and learn about TIA and sort of pitch their ideas and compete for contract work under the program. Whether or not, though, those tools were actually taken and applied, not sure. I interviewed Poindexter's number two from TIA, a guy named Dr. Robert Popp, and asked him specifically, did NSA analysts or anyone else at NSA take these TIA tools and use them as part of this domestic surveillance program? And his response was, he said he could tell me that under Total Information Awareness, under that program, which he and Poindexter were in charge of, he knew that they had not taken those tools and used them in the domestic surveillance. However, what they did on their own time, he could not speak to that. He wasn't sure.
And what has come of John Poindexter?
John Poindexter now lives outside Washington and is a private consultant. I did contact him for this story. He was unwilling to comment about former TIA programs on the record for this.
You mentioned SAIC that was also involved with running the media in Iraq, though they lost that contract, and it went to the Melbourne, Florida-based company, Harris Corporation. Is Harris involved with this?
I have not seen any documents on Harris Corporation's involvement, but SAIC was probably the most significant contractor in the whole TIA program. And it's important to note that at the time that TIA was started up, the wholly owned subsidiary of SAIC that was the main contractor for the program was a company called Hicks & Associates. Hicks & Associates is headed by a number of former defense and intelligence officials, and one of the top executives there was a guy named Brian Sharkey, Brian Sharkey being a friend of John Poindexter who helped pitch this idea to the Pentagon after 9/11. So, you know, this is a fairly closed community of people and of experts with officials in the Defense Department and at contractors, primarily SAIC in this case.
And is there any word among those in Congress, in the House or the Senate, that they're going to be looking into this? Since, of course, the general perception of the public is that TIA is over. Total information awareness was over in all its forms.
Right. Well, I think the story broke on Friday, so I personally haven't heard anything for what Congress plans, but certainly Senator Wyden, you played the clip from the hearing from a few weeks back, appears to be, by his line of questioning, interested in exactly what happened to these programs. And, of course, as you played the part where General Michael Hayden said that he would respond to the questions in closed sessions, and all I can presume is that he answered Senator Wyden's question about whether programs live on in the affirmative.
Shane Harris, I want to thank you very much for joining us from National Journal. Broke the story on total information awareness living on. We will link to it at democracynow.org. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we return, hundreds of men held without charge for years. No, not Guantanamo. Bagram in Afghanistan, and it's growing. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting on over 400 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM, college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS stations, and on both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV and 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we are video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. While an international debate rages over the future of the American detention center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, the military has quietly expanded another less visible prison in Afghanistan, where it now holds some 500 terror suspects in more primitive conditions, indefinitely and without charges. That's the opening line of a front-page article in Sunday's New York Times detailing the U.S.-run prison at Bagram Air Base north of Kabul. The Times reports some of the detainees at Bagram have been held for as long as 2 or 3 years. Unlike those at Guantanamo, they have no access to lawyers, no right to hear the allegations against them, and only rudimentary reviews of their status as enemy combatants. One Pentagon official told The Times the current average stay of prisoners at Bagram is 14.5 months. The numbers of detainees at the base had risen from about 100 at the start of 2004 to as many as 600 at times last year. The paper says the increase is in part the result of a decision by the U.S. government to shut off the flow of detainees to Guantanamo Bay after the Supreme Court ruled that those prisoners had some basic due process rights. The question of whether those same rights apply to detainees in Bagram has not been tested in court. While Guantanamo offers carefully scripted tours for members of Congress and journalists, Bagram has operated in rigorous secrecy since it opened in 2002. It bars outside visitors, except for the International Red Cross, and refuses to make public the names of those held there. The prison may not be photographed, even from a distance. Citing unnamed military officials and former detainees, The New York Times reports prisoners at Bagram are held by the dozen in wire cages, sleep on the floor and foam mats, and are often made to use plastic buckets for latrines. Before recent renovations, detainees rarely saw daylight except for brief visits to a small exercise yard. The U.S. military Sunday defended Bagram Air Base, saying detainees there are treated humanely and provided, quote, the best possible living conditions. But evidence of abuse of prisoners at Bagram has emerged over the years. In December 2002, two Afghan prisoners were found dead, hanging by their shackled wrists in isolation cells at the prison. An army investigation showed they were treated harshly by interrogators, deprived of sleep for days, struck so often in the legs by guards that a coroner compared the injuries to being run over by a bus. No one has been prosecuted for the deaths, though both were ruled homicides, and the army claims the men were beaten to death inside the jail. We're joined on the phone right now from London by Clive Stafford Smith, a British-born human rights lawyer who represents 40 detainees at Guantanamo Bay, many of whom passed through the Bagram Air Base. He's legal director of the charity Reprieve. He joins us on the phone from London. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about what you know of Bagram?
Well, yes, and of course a lot of it's laid out in the New York Times, but there are some things that are considerably worse than represented there. For example, there's an area of Bagram that is not open to the Red Cross. As one of our clients, Mamdou Habib, said, the most frightening moment he had in Bagram was when the Red Cross came and he didn't get to see them. And there's a cellar area in Bagram, a place that's kept perpetually dark, which is where a number of prisoners are kept away from the Red Cross itself. And, of course, if you think about being a prisoner in those circumstances, your natural assumption is if the military doesn't want the Red Cross to know you exist, then your fate is probably not going to be a very pleasant one. And naturally, a number of those people have been moved off and rendered to other countries where they've been abused. And some of them we've caught up with again in Guantanamo, but many we haven't. They've disappeared.
We're also joined in our studio by Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Does the center represent people at Bagram?
Well, like Clive, the center has many of the similar clients who have been through Bagram on their way to Guantanamo. And Mozambique is another one whose story has just come out, how he was taken to Bagram, beaten, et cetera, and then went to Guantanamo. We are in contact with people who have family members, who have people in Guantanamo. And as Clive said, a lot of this has been known for a couple of more than two or three years. I mean, the people who were hung and tortured and killed. The underground prison has been known. And what's really incredibly frustrating, you feel like Sisyphus rolling the stone up the hill, when you think about finally getting some rights for people and visits to Guantanamo, and then what happens is the administration really goes and continues its illegality in other prisons around the world. So what it really says is that, yes, the struggle is around one prison like Guantanamo, but we have to really root out completely what this administration is doing around the world.
Now, can you, though, explain? It sounds like the reason Bagram is growing is because of all of the international outcry around Guantanamo, but also Guantanamo's legal relationship with the United States on a U.S. air base in Cuba. Can you explain the legality of Afghanistan, where Bagram is, and Guantanamo, these two detention camps?
Well, both Clive and I were in the early case about Guantanamo, in which the U.S. tried to say Guantanamo was like Bagram, that there were no legal rights there. You couldn't go to court for people in Guantanamo. They had no constitutional rights, and the U.S. said it could do what it wanted to people at Guantanamo. We won a big case in the Supreme Court, the Razul case, in June of 2004, that opened the courts to people at Guantanamo and opened them so people like Clive and center lawyers could go to Guantanamo. Even with those set of rights, the administration in the Graham-Levin bill and the Detainee Treatment Act is trying to eliminate even those rights we won in the Supreme Court. But as far as Bagram's concerned, the legal position of the administration is similar to what it was about Guantanamo. There are no legal rights, but they have the additional argument that they would make that because it's not on a U.S. permanent military base like the one in Cuba, that there's even fewer rights. I don't think they're correct. I think that any person detained anywhere in the world has a right to go into a court, has a right to be visited by an attorney. But the administration's view is whatever Guantanamo rights are, the rights at Guantanamo are the rights at Bagram are nil, absolutely none. And so what they did, according to the Times report, was a few months after we won the Razul case, they said they stopped sending people to Guantanamo and started sending them to other places. Bagram is the one that we know the most about at this point, because the administration's view is that no court, no lawyer, no one has any right to visit anyone in Guantanamo, anyone in Bagram, and that nobody and that the people at Bagram have no legal rights at all. An extraordinary statement in today's world.
Clive Stafford Smith, your response, and also what is the role, if any, of Britain in Bagram?
Well, my response is that I think, as Michael and I and many others have said for a long time, Guantanamo is something abstraction. That the people, if you think people have been badly treated in Guantanamo, you should see what's happened to them in other places. And what's of real concern arising out of the New York Times article is this. The Times mentioned one flight. It was actually September the 19th, 2004, where 10 people were brought to Guantanamo. I represent a couple of those. And of those 10, all of them are extraordinary cases where people were taken and abused horribly in other places. One of my clients is Benyam Mohammed. He was rendered to Morocco. We've got the flight logs. We know the very names of the soldiers who were on the flight. And he was taken there, and he was tortured for 18 months, a razor blade taken to his penis, for goodness sake. And now the U.S. military is putting him on trial in Guantanamo. Hassan Bin Attash, 17-year-old juvenile who was taken to Jordan and tortured there for 16 months. There's a series of these people. Now, what that prompts is this question, that the people who have been most mistreated in Guantanamo were mistreated elsewhere, and then the administration took a very small number of them to Guantanamo, but the vast majority of them are either in Bagram or in these secret prisons around the world. And most recently, we heard of Poland, we've heard of Morocco, we've heard of various places. What I'm afraid is the truth is that the most shocking abuses have yet to come to light, that these people are in Bagram and have yet to talk to anybody. And what the administration is doing is hiding these ghastly secrets. Now, the question is, what are they going to do about that? What are they going to do when it becomes necessary at some point for these prisoners to be given lawyers? There's a lot of horror stories, and the administration's just not going to want those horror stories to come out. So where are these prisoners going to be sent? Are they going to vanish forever? And unfortunately, the U.S. administration has shown that it's willing to send people to Egypt, where they may disappear, to Morocco, where they get razor blades taken to them. And we've got to find out the names of these people first, and because the government won't tell us. And then we've got to prevent them from being rendered to some country where they effectively die after a bit of torture. I'll be glad to go on to the British part, but I've talked too much. I don't want to rant on forever.
Oh. Clive Stafford Smith, I wanted to ask you about a piece that appeared in a paper in your country, in The Guardian, by Suzanne Goldenberg and James Meek. It says, new evidence has emerged that U.S. forces in Afghanistan engage in widespread Abu Ghraib-style abuse, taking trophy photographs of detainees and carrying out rape and sexual humiliation. Documents obtained by The Guardian contain evidence that such abuse took place in the main detention center at Bagram near the capital, Kabul, as well as at a smaller U.S. installation near the southern city of Kandahar. 1,000 pages of evidence from U.S. Army investigations released to the ACLU after a long battle made available to The Guardian. And then inside, it says the latest allegations from Afghanistan fit a pattern of claims of brutal treatment made by former Guantanamo Bay prisoners and Afghans held by the U.S. In December, the U.S. said 8 prisoners had died in custody in Afghanistan. And this is according to you. A Palestinian says he was sodomized by American soldiers in Afghanistan. Another former prisoner of U.S. forces, a Jordanian, describes a form of torture which involved being hung in a cage from a rope for days. Hussein Abdelkader Youssef Mustafa, a Palestinian living in Jordan, told Clive Stafford Smith he was sodomized by U.S. soldiers during detention at Bagram in 2002. He said they forcibly rammed a stick up my rectum, excruciatingly painful. Only when the pain became overwhelming did I think I would ever scream, but I could not stop screaming when this happened.
Yeah, you know, Hussein Mustafa, I met with him in Jordan, and he was an incredibly credible person. He's a dignified older gentleman, about 50 years old, and he wanted to talk about what had happened to him, but he really didn't want to talk about that sexual stuff. And in the end, you know, I said to him, look, you don't have to, but it's very important if things happened that the story get out so they don't happen to other people. And in the end, he did, and it was in front of half a dozen people who were just transfixed as he described how four soldiers took him, one on each shoulder, one bent down his head, and then the fourth of them took this broomstick and shoved it up his rectum. Now, there was no one in that room, and they were from a variety of places who didn't believe what this man was saying. It was true, but I'm afraid, I've got to tell you, that that's far from the worst that's happened. When you talk about Bagram, when you talk about Kandahar, those aren't the worst places the U.S. has run in Afghanistan. The dark prison, sometimes called the salt pit in Kabul itself, which is separate from Bagram, has been far worse than that. And I can tell you stories from there that just make your skin crawl.
Well, why don't you tell us something about this place?
I'll tell you some of the ones, for example, that Binyam Muhammad told me. He was the man who had the razor blade taken to him. He was then taken, and again, we can prove it. We got the flight logs. He was taken on January the 21st, 2004, to Kabul, where he was put in this dark prison for 5 months. And he was shackled. You just get this vision of the Middle Ages, where he's shackled on the wall with his hands up so he can't quite sit down. It's totally dark in that place. When the U.S. says that people are being treated nicely in Bagram, you've got to be kidding me. It's the middle of winter, and they're freezing to death. And this man was in this cell, no heating, absolutely freezing, no clothing except for his shorts, totally dark for 24 hours a day with this howling noise around him. They began with Eminem music, interestingly enough. They played him Eminem music for 24 hours a day for 20 days. Seems to me Eminem ought to be suing them for royalties over that. But then it got worse, and they started doing these screeching noises. And this is going on 24 hours a day. And in the meantime, they bring him out very briefly just to beat him. And this is to try to get this man to confess to stories that they now want him to repeat in military commissions in Guantanamo. And they want to say, oh, everything's nice now. And what he went through, he said, was far worse than the physical torture, this psychological torture that some pervert was running in the dark prison in Kabul. It was worse to him, and he still suffers from it day in, day out because of what it's done to his mind. And this is what we have to remember is there's someone out there who's thinking this stuff up and who's then saying we need to do it. And this isn't some lowly guard who loses control and does something terrible that's physical. I mean, that's awful. But you've got someone out there who's thinking through how we're going to torture these people with this excruciating noise and these other things. And they're doing this very, very consciously. And the story has a long way before it's going to be out fully.
So, Michael Ratner, what oversight is there?
Well, as Clive is saying, there isn't. And I think, you know, we're putting this huge effort into closing down Guantanamo, which is crucial, obviously, to do. It'll be a major victory. But what we're running is these so-called black sites, torture chambers, all around the world. And there isn't any oversight. Our Congress is just sitting on its hands, not doing anything. Most they ask is, say, give us a report on black sites. Even that isn't getting through. We have nothing. This country is running torture chambers around the world right now. And Clive's stories, our client's stories, are incredibly dramatic. And his point about the psychological torture is crucial. It's what Clive is saying. People have thought about this, but this is something that has been U.S. policy for 40 years of how to really deal with people, not just physically, but with psychological torture. And one of your former guests, I think Al McCoy, had this on in the question of torture, saying this is what really affects people. Physically, yes, hurts them, but the psychological marks of torture. And when you see the pictures from Bagram to Guantanamo, you know that this is stuff that is not just chance or random. This is going by the book.
I wanted to talk about this article in the New Yorker that Jane Mayer had written about Colonel Louis Morgan Banks, a senior Army psychologist who played a significant advisory role in interrogations at Guantanamo Bay. Asked to provide details of his consulting work, he said, quote, "I just don't remember any particular cases. I just consulted generally on what approaches to take. It was about what human behavior in captivity is like." Banks has a PhD in psychology from the University of Southern Mississippi. A biographical statement for an American Psychological Association task force on psychological ethics and national security, which Banks serves on, mentions that he, quote, provides technical support and consultation to all Army psychologists providing interrogation support. It also notes that starting in November of 2001, Banks was detailed to Afghanistan, where he spent 4 months at Bagram Airfield, quote, supporting combat operations against al-Qaeda and Taliban fighters.
Well, what's remarkable about Banks is he also consulted on Guantanamo. So here you have this guy who's a psychologist consulting really on how to break people through psychological torture is what I would call it. And then he goes from Guantanamo to Bagram. This is not chance. This is not a few bad apples. This is high-level military people working with our military, our CIA, in how to break people through torture.
And when you're talking break people, and I think that's a very important word, you know, people bang on about whether it's torture or whether it's coercion. Well, our highest officials have said that the purpose of all of this is to, quote, break somebody. And we get people to confess to stuff that's absolute drivel. I mean, you take, for example, Benyam Mohamed again. You have a razor blade taken to you. You have the psychological stuff. You're going to say anything. They got Benyam Mohamed to confess that he had dinner with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Ramzi Ben Al-Shib, Abu Zubaydah, Sheikh Al-Libi, and Jose Padilla, all together on April the 3rd, 2002 in Pakistan. Well, you know, quite apart from anything else, two of them, Abu Zubaydah and Sheikh Al-Libi, were in U.S. custody at the time when he confessed to that, and at the time he was meant to be having dinner. And, you know, this is a guy who didn't speak Arabic, who was meant to be hobnobbing with half of al-Qaeda. And you get this total drivel out of this breaking of people, and yet for some reason, the people who are designing Guantanamo think we should carry on breaking them. It's the Spanish Inquisition. It's very odd.
That's correct. I mean, they break them, they get drivel, they get false stories. And so what's going on? What's going on, I think, in part, is an attempt to terrorize people, terrorize the Muslim world, and say, you come into U.S. hands and we will terrorize you. And that's what they're doing.
Don't you think, though, Michael? I tell you, I think there's a slightly bigger danger here, which is people who are doing this abuse believe the stuff they get. This is what's frightening to me, that we end up making decisions based on this nonsense.
You know, it's true. They do believe it. I think when you talk to your clients or we talk to ours, the people who are interrogating them actually believe what they're telling them, even though it's utterly and complete drivel.
We're going to have to leave it there. Joining us next is Maher Arar. He is a Canadian citizen who was, well, the U.S. government calls it extraordinary rendition. Others call it kidnapped when he was transiting through Kennedy Airport from a family vacation to Canada and sent to Syria, was tortured there and held for almost a year. We've been speaking with Clive Stafford Smith, a British human rights lawyer. Michael Ratner will stay with us, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, back in a minute.
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A U.S. federal judge has dismissed a lawsuit filed by a Canadian citizen against the U.S. government for detaining him and sending him to Syria, where he was jailed and tortured. Maher Arar was the first person to mount a civil suit challenging the U.S. government policy known as Extraordinary Rendition. In October 2002, he was detained at JFK Airport while on a stopover in New York. He was then jailed, secretly deported to Syria. He was held for almost a year without charge in an underground cell not much larger than a grave. Charges were never filed against him. In a ruling earlier this month, the federal judge, David Traeger, said he could not interfere in the case because it involves crucial national security and foreign relations issues. In an 88-page judgment, Traeger wrote, quote, "One need not have much imagination to contemplate the negative effect on our relations with Canada if discovery were to proceed in this case and were it to turn out that certain high Canadian officials had, despite public denials, acquiesced in Arar's removal to Syria." The Center for Constitutional Rights launched the lawsuit on Arar's behalf in January 2004 against former Attorney General John Ashcroft and other U.S. officials seeking undisclosed damages. Maher Arar joins us on the line right now from Ottawa. Michael Ratner is still in the studio with us from the Center for Constitutional Rights. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Maher Arar.
Thank you for inviting me to this.
Your response to the judge's dismissal of your case?
Well, it was quite shocking. I was not expecting him to dismiss the entire case. All I can say is that in his ruling, it seems that the court system is risking becoming complicit with the Bush administration when it comes to torture.
Can you explain briefly what did happen to you, how you ended up in the U.S. government's hands at JFK Airport?
Well, I was on, I had traveled to the States before. I had worked in the States. I was not expecting anything really that serious to happen. I was stopped and asked routine questions at the beginning. I cooperated fully. Of course, they denied the, they didn't allow me to make a phone call. But all of a sudden, they, you know, after 2 days of intense interrogation, they chain and shackled me and took me to the Metropolitan Detention Center. And, you know, 10 days later, they just secretly deported me to Syria without having, I was not afforded any kind of due process. I was not afforded the basic rights of, I do not want to say an American, basic right of human being.
What did they do to you in Syria?
Well, you know, they sent me to a country where it is common knowledge that they torture detainees. I spent there a year, 10 months of which I was placed in an underground cell. Of course, this is not to mention the beatings, the physical beatings I endured at the beginning when I arrived in Syria. But I can tell you the psychological torture that I endured during this 10-month period in the underground cell is really beyond human imagination. It is beyond human imagination.
And through my lawsuit, I wanted to
hold these people accountable for what they did to me. But unfortunately, the judge dismissed the entire case. It is really sad.
Michael Ratner, what about the rationale that the judge used to dismiss this case?
Well, you know, this was one of the most remarkable and infamous and worst decisions I've ever read by a federal judge. I mean, what it really is saying is it gives a green light to the U.S. to take people like Maher Arar and send them overseas for torture. You understand that he had to accept the allegation that this United States government, the Bush administration, intentionally sent Arar over to Syria to be tortured. And on that allegation, he said, we cannot go into this case because of national security. And even worse, in my view, even worse, he wrote an opinion that said it might be one thing to torture somebody for purposes of getting evidence for a criminal case. That, he said, I agree, is unconstitutional. But it's not yet sure under the Constitution, or it's still an open question of whether if you torture someone for purposes of preventing terrorism, whether that is unconstitutional. In other words, he's buying into the argument, buying into it, that you might be able to torture people if your purpose is to prevent terrorism. This is coming from a federal judge. What's happened here is the idea that torture is somehow a legitimate means in the so-called war on terror is now seeping into not just this administration and the executive, into the judiciary, into obviously the pundits and everything else. It's one of the most, I mean, I was incredibly flabbergasted when I read that. In other words, you can torture for one reason, but you can't torture for another. What else do we have to say? This is Pinochet. This is Pinochet saying, I can torture in the name of national security. And this is our client on the phone, Maher Arar, who had this happen to him, who was sent to a place by the United States to be tortured.
We wanted to go for a minute to Alfred McCoy. We interviewed him a few days ago. He's a professor of history at University of Wisconsin-Madison and author of A Question of Torture, CIA Interrogation from the Cold War to the War on Terror. The book gives an account of the CIA's secret efforts to develop new forms of torture spanning half century. This is a clip of what Professor McCoy had to say.
Now, this produced a distinctively American form of torture, the first real revolution in the cruel science of pain in centuries, psychological torture. And it's the one that's with us today. And it's proved to be a very resilient, quite adaptable, and enormously destructive paradigm. Let's make one thing clear. Americans refer to this oftentimes in common parlance as torture light. Psychological torture, people who are involved in treatment tell us, is far more destructive, does far more lasting damage to the human psyche than does physical torture. As Senator McCain said himself last year when he was debating his torture prohibition, faced with the choice between being beaten and psychologically tortured, I'd rather be beaten. Okay? It does far more lasting damage. It's far crueler than physical torture. This is something we don't realize in this country.
That's Professor Al McCoy. Maher Arar, from your experience of being held for almost a year in Syrian jail, your response?
Well, I do agree 100% with what I just heard. I can tell you, for example, during the first 2 weeks of my stay in Syria, I was physically beaten. What happened during this initial period is I just wanted them to leave me alone, even in that dark and dumped underground cell. But after a while, the psychological torture that I endured during this lengthy period, I was ready. Especially by the end of my stay, by the end of the 10-month period in this underground cell, I was ready, frankly, to confess to anything. I would just write anything so that they could only take me from that place and put me in a place where it is fit for human being. I was not only that, I was ready to endure more physical beatings, just to get rid of this place.
And what did
I do agree 100% with what it's a personal experience I lived, and I think if you ask other torture victims who have been psychologically tortured, they would tell you the same thing.
And so what did you confess to?
Well, the false confession was, frankly, at the beginning, they wanted me to say that I've been to Afghanistan, which I ended up saying anyway. But what I'm referring to here, even by after 10 months, of that psychological torture. If they ask me to sign another false confession and they tell me, listen, if you sign this, we'll take you to a different place where you could live as a human being, I would have signed anything.
The effects on you today, Maher Arar, you have been released, you haven't been charged, but the effects of what happened to you in Syria?
You know, I'm completely a different person. I still have fears. I don't take the plane anymore. I don't fly. I lost confidence in myself. I feel overwhelmed. There's some kind of emotional distancing between me and my kids and my family. They ruined my life. And I have not been able to find a job. People try to, you know, some people I know, they try to distance themselves from me. It's I don't know how to describe it. I don't think there is any word I could use to describe what I'm going through. And I thought when I came back, it would take me a month or 2 months or a year or 2 years to get back to normal life. It's been 2 years and 4 months since I came back to Canada, and there are things that I've improved a little bit, but I'm still not the same person, and I'm still suffering psychologically.
Will you appeal the decision?
One thing I know is I'm not going to give up, whether it's through appealing or some other process. I have not discussed the details with my lawyers yet, but apparently and most likely we're going to be appealing the decision.
Maharaj, I want to thank you very much for joining us from your home in Ottawa, Canada. And Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, that has taken on Maher's case. The center has put out a new book. It's called Articles of Impeachment Against George W. Bush. And that does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Shriho Dokadoosh, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Maddie Harper, Aaron Mate, Mike DeFilippo was our engineer. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.